At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've been getting quite an education recently about how the nation's student loan programs work. The New York Attorney General served 13 more lenders with subpoenas today. But no matter the scandal, the country's biggest student loan company got an A today. A for acquisition. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Monday, the 16th of April. Today's lesson will address corporate takeovers. Sallie Mae, the nation's largest student loan company, accepted a bid from two big banks and two private equity firms. The price tag, $25 billion. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on what the buyout means amid calls to cut federal subsidies to Sallie Mae.
You gotta wonder what Sallie Mae's buyers, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and two private equity investors, are thinking. Sure, Sallie Mae originated $23 billion in student loans last year, but the federal government appears to be moving away from subsidies for private lenders and toward direct government-to-student loans. And Jonathan Coppell at the Yale School of Management says taking Sallie Mae private will raise some eyebrows in Washington.
It's not a government-sponsored enterprise anymore, but it once was, and it still is seen as having a highly public mission, financing student borrowing. There's a great deal of concern whenever you have a transaction like this that the public mission is going to be somehow compromised.
As a result of the deal, two Wall Street rating services warned they may cut the grade they give Sallie Mae's debt. Plus, several state investigations into kickbacks between lenders and colleges are expanding. While Sallie Mae has already settled one case, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo today issued subpoenas and information requests to 13 more lenders, including the two banks that want to buy Sallie Mae. Still, Sandy Baum, an economics professor at Skidmore College, says don't count Sallie Mae out just yet.
The most rapidly growing component of student borrowing is actually private loans. And Sallie Mae is a major player in the private student loan market.
Sallie Mae's buyers are placing a big bet the company will continue to be the dominant player in a newly competitive private market for student lending. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So with this $25 billion Sallie Mae takeover in the news, a deal worth a little over $3 billion might seem like small fry. But the $3 billion that Google plunked down for the internet ad company DoubleClick is big fry, especially for those who remember, 3 seconds ago when everybody said internet advertising was dead. No, it's far from dead. In fact, this move has scared multiple players, including Microsoft, into lobbying antitrust accusations at the deal. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains.
This isn't just a case of Google envy. This is about the future of internet advertising. Who gets to control this increasingly important market is at issue, and some say the deal would give Google 80% of it. Ken Wilber teaches advertising at the University of Southern California. He says when you add DoubleClick to Google, you could get big trouble.
There are real concerns about creating a dominant position and having potentially anti-competitive effects when you allow one firm to become a monopoly.
Funny that Microsoft and AT&T seem to be leading the antitrust charge against the Google DoubleClick deal, since both dominate their particular industries. Internet advertiser Israel Rothman suggests sour grapes.
Microsoft is not the innovative, quick-moving company it was when Bill Gates started it. It's become a lumbering public dinosaur. Everybody's losing their market share, and Google keeps winning. And this is just another step, really, in the right direction for them to get bigger.
And it's not just on the internet where you see Google getting bigger. The company also just announced a deal to sell ads for radio giant Clear Channel. In the meantime, Google's internet rivals may be jealous, but they're not giving up. Today, the one-time search leader Yahoo said it's expanding its collaboration with groups of newspapers. They're eager to snatch up more of the expanding online advertising pie. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Oil and water do not mix, but oil and fat do. So it should be no surprise that a major oil company has taken an interest in chicken fat and cow fat and pig fat. ConocoPhillips and Tyson Foods say they're joining forces to create renewable diesel fuel, food not for you, but for your car. Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Talk about burning fat. Tyson Food is going to start sending beef fat from a plant in Texas to a ConocoPhillips refinery nearby. The refined fat will actually be mixed with regular diesel fuel, and voila, you have black gold. Lou Burke of ConocoPhillips says the fat isn't biodiesel. He calls it renewable diesel. He says it'll help stretch diesel fuel supplies, and users will never know the difference.
3 to 10% of it will be renewable diesel. The product, it'll be marketed to the product as just plain old diesel fuel.
ConocoPhillips will produce about 175 million gallons of renewable diesel per year. That's only about 0.5% of its U.S. refinery business, and Burke says the company can't even do that without government subsidies. But Joseph Jobe of the National Biodiesel Board says the federal funding was meant for true biodiesel, mostly from vegetable oils. He says ConocoPhillips officials pressured the Bush administration into giving them the federal money.
It will cost taxpayers millions of dollars, and it will have a chilling effect on the continued momentum of the biodiesel industry.
Throwing fuel on the fire, Jobe says small biofuel companies will begin fighting with ConocoPhillips over fat, and prices are headed up.
Yeah, we're already seeing some speculation in the marketplace from this.
ConocoPhillips officials say fat is just the beginning, and they're experimenting with other fuel sources like algae. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, investors galloped like Mustangs after the Sallie Mae announcement. Details when we do the numbers. It's April 16th. Do you know where your Form 1040 is? If not, you've got about 24 hours to find it, fill it out, sign it, stamp it, and mail it. Unless, of course, you're filing electronically. No matter how you do your taxes, it's rarely a pleasant experience. One reason why Democratic presidential hopeful John Edwards recently suggested that the IRS fill out the forms for us. Commentator Ian Ayers says, yeah.
Imagine if Visa required us to keep copies of all our charges and then told us to fill in a blank form reporting how much we spent. No, customers expect Visa to start the ball rolling by sending them a bill. But the IRS requires us taxpayers to keep copies of our W-2 and 1099 forms. That's crazy. The IRS already has all the information it needs to fill out the complete forms for millions of wage income taxpayers who don't itemize their deductions. Of course, we wouldn't want to force anyone to use the IRS's pre-completed form. They could revise it, or they could just throw it away and start from scratch. but as many as 50 million Americans wouldn't need to change a thing, and there are 50 million more where the IRS could make a darn good start. The feds even know enough to complete your state form for you while they're at it. This isn't some pie-in-the-sky idea. California's Ready Return project already shows that it can work. In 2005, over 11,000 Californians used tax returns that the state had filled out for them in advance. Of course, the tax preparation industry stands to lose a bundle, and that's why it's fighting the idea. Intuit, the maker of TurboTax, poured more than $1 million into the California comptroller's race last year in an attempt to seize control of the state's franchise tax board. They succeeded in killing the program for 2006 returns, but the program will expand to up to 1 million prepared returns in 2007. Almost all the Californians who tried the program loved it. They wrote in personal comments like, "Fantastic service, go governator," and finally, "Government is doing something to make our lives easier for a change." Now, isn't that the least the IRS can do?
Ian Ayers teaches law at Yale Law School. Your thoughts? Send them to letters@marketplace.org. Believe me or not, and I know residents of the Midwest and East Coast probably won't, spring is here. Roses are blooming, daisies are cropping up on hillsides and in garden beds. But if flowers fill the vase on your coffee table, chances are they're pre-cut and store-bought, and you probably paid a pretty posy penny for them. Cut flowers are a $40 billion industry. Amy Stewart writes about it in her new book, Flower Confidential. She joined me in my garden recently to talk about what sets cut flowers apart from those you can grow yourself.
I really have always had a sense that the flowers that you can buy in a flower shop are different from what we grow in our own gardens. I mean, have you ever grown a carnation in your garden?
No, and I never will.
That's right. And yet they're one of the top three selling flowers in the United States. And the first time I went to a flower farm, it just so happens that Sun Valley, which is the largest grower of cut flowers in the country, is right down the street from me in Northern California. And the first time I went there, I realized this is a factory. These plants aren't even growing in the ground. They're being grown hydroponically in these plastic containers. They're on an assembly line being cut and processed. This is merchandise.
Where do most of our flowers come from?
Well, most of the cut flowers that we buy in the United States are coming from Latin America. About 78% of our flowers are imported now.
And those 78%?
78%. And that number's growing every year.
Why is that?
It was really an economic decision. You know, in the 60s, some businessmen took a look at where in the world flowers could be grown, where there would be very low energy costs because the climate would be perfect, where wages are low. And because by then, commercial jet travel was becoming more and more widespread, it actually became possible to grow flowers on the equator, where the climate's perfect, and fly them out of Bogota or out of Quito into Miami and then drive them across the country on our, what at that time was sort of our newly perfected interstate highway system.
That seems like an awful long way for a cut flower to go. How does it stay so pretty when I buy it at the florist?
Yeah, it is a long way for them to go. And you know, it is all about temperature. I went down to Ecuador and walked through greenhouses. And let me tell you, it is a race to get them out of the greenhouse as soon as they've been cut and get them into the production rooms where they can be chilled down to 34 to 38 degrees. If you can keep a flower cold, you can keep it fresh for a surprisingly long period of time. The longer it sits out, you know, in warm temperatures or even room temperatures, the more vase life you use.
A lot of people, I think, don't really think about it unless and until, you know, they go to the florist and they have to pay $40 or $50 for a nice arrangement. It's very expensive to get flowers in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot goes into those flowers. I mean, you start with how they're bred. I've talked to breeders who have already invested $10 million in one flower. So you think about that kind of money going up front just to create a flower that everyone would want, like a blue rose or something really exotic and extraordinary. And they're collecting royalties. You know, the growers are paying royalties back to the breeders, much like in the music industry or the publishing industry. And then, of course, the flowers have to be grown and cut and shipped, usually on refrigerated trucks and planes. I mean, there is a lot of infrastructure that goes into just physically getting the flowers to the flower shop.
Wow. Well, I noticed when I go to a big box store that they're a whole lot less expensive there than if I were to go to a florist or even my local supermarket.
When you're paying less for flowers, here's the issue. You may be getting different varieties, cheaper varieties. Also, grocery stores or just any kind of big box kind of outlet like that is probably less likely to refrigerate the flowers properly, which means they're losing vase life very quickly. If they're anywhere near the produce department, produce gives off a tremendous amount of ethylene. That causes flowers to wilt. So anytime I walk into a grocery store and I see one of those big bins of apples and right next to it I see the floral department, I'll never buy those flowers. Those flowers are not going to last. It's very interesting to me that grocery stores know how to take care of all their other perishable products, but they, in many cases, don't know how to take care of their flowers.
Well, Amy Stewart, thank you so much for visiting me in my backyard.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll check in with Hurricane Katrina survivor Ethel Curry. Last time we spoke with her, she still hadn't rebuilt her home.
Then came Guiding Light, and we're not talking about a faith-based organization.
But first, let's do the numbers. That Sallie Mae deal helped boost the Dow up 108 points, more than 0.8% to land at 12,720. The Nasdaq jumped 26 points, 1% to close at 2518. The S&P ponied up 15 points, 1% to finish the day at 1468, the highest close since 2000. The $25 billion buyout helped Sallie Mae shares rise more than 18% in trading today. Two of the firms involved in that deal also got a big boost. Bank of America gained 1.6%, J.P. Morgan Chase 1.75%. And in honor of tax season, investors were definitely not withholding from H&R Block. The tax giant added almost 2% in trading today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.73%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Ever hear a song on Marketplace, but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to the Public Radio Music Source, where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for March. The House Financial Services Committee discusses the rising number of mortgage foreclosures. And the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee examines the proposed merger of satellite radios XM and Sirius. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdal. Today, Sudan agreed to accept 3,000 peacekeeping troops in Darfur. Washington isn't entirely happy with the development because there's still no decision on who will take charge of the predominantly African force. More than 200,000 people have been slaughtered in Darfur, another 2.5 million displaced. Since 1997, Sudan has been subject to U.S. economic sanctions, and there are threats of even stiffer penalties. But Gretchen Wilson reports there's no shortage of investors in the local economy.
On this dusty stretch of land between the blue and white Niles, all I see is red earth. But in an air-conditioned trailer a few yards away, Amir Deglal of the El Sunnet Development Company says I just need to look harder.
You could see that according to the master plan here, the golf course is just nearby to the El Sunnet Forest.
Wait a minute. Back up. Golf course? In Sudan?
This is where you could just have all the, it's like a Tiger Woods and the famous people around the world, they come and play on it.
Yep, Sudan's planning its first golf course, part of a $4.5 billion development here. What gets lost in media coverage about Sudan is the huge economic story happening here. Most people have heard the horror stories about Darfur, the killings and full villages on the run, key reasons why North American and European companies have largely quit doing business here. But rather than buckling under U.S.-led sanctions, Sudan looked around for a new economic formula.
We have reoriented our trade and investment policies to the East and not to the West, because the West has largely shunned our country.
Abdul Rahim Hamdi is Sudan's former finance minister and an architect of Sudan's economic program. Now, instead of doing business with the U.S., it's doing phenomenal business with China, India, Malaysia, and the Persian Gulf.
First of all, they don't meddle into our internal affairs in any way. No issues about human rights. They don't go out and try to impose sanctions in Geneva or in United Nations and so on and brand us as a rogue country.
Sudan's oil boom has made it one of the world's fastest-growing economies. Direct foreign investment topped $3.8 billion in 2005, and GDP has doubled in the last 3 years alone. China is now Sudan's biggest trade partner. In the last decade, it's locked a 40% stake in the oil industry. It also loans Sudan money at attractive terms. No surprise, then, it wins multi-million dollar contracts to develop pipelines and dams.
Sudan has become a very, very important market for Chinese manufacturers.
Wang Jiang's company makes heavy machinery used to build roads and bridges. Today, he meets prospective buyers at a trendy outdoor cafe. Wang understands the reasons behind U.S. sanctions, but he and other investors told me they're not sure they even trust the West's view of what's happening in Darfur. All the more reason to develop clients in a fast-growing market while pouring cash into a nation in need of development.
The most important thing for Chinese manufacturers is how we can go into this market as quick as possible. Because if we go to the market slowly, maybe the competitors from America and the European country will go in.
But of course, it's not just China pouring money into Sudan.
The profit in Sudan is very high.
There's a very big opportunity here.
The economy here is booming.
India, Malaysia, and many other nations are all securing major oil construction and transport contracts. And some fear that Sudan's economic success will bolster the resolve of other regimes the U.S. doesn't like. But investment here is not going to stop anytime soon, as emerging economies jockey for natural resources. Ross Herbert is with the South African Institute of International Affairs.
Heretofore, the economic center of the world was somewhere between the United States and Europe, and that center of gravity is shifting. So what's happening in Africa is a manifestation of that competition.
The U.S. and its allies want U.N. troops to take over peacekeeping in Darfur. But the emerging face of the global economy means there's less of a reason for the government of Sudan to take note. In Khartoum, Sudan, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Ethel Curry lost her house to Hurricane Katrina in August of 2005. She survived the floodwaters by climbing into her open refrigerator, which was floating against the ceiling of her home.
And I say, Lord, please take it down, because if it come any higher, I can't swim. Well, I was through the rafters, holding my head up, trying to keep it, you know, from getting out of my mouth, because I couldn't stand it.
Last time we visited with her, a year after the disaster, she was still living in a FEMA trailer and still waiting for help from volunteer groups rebuilding homes on the Gulf Coast. Stephen Smith of American Radio Works tells us the help finally came this winter from an unlikely place.
In the wake of a disaster like Hurricane Katrina, some people get back on their feet more slowly than others, some not at all. Circumstances and luck can have a lot to do with it. For 61-year-old Ethel Curry, bad luck and bad circumstances left her ineligible for most of the government and nonprofit recovery programs in Mississippi. Then came Guiding Light, and we're not talking about a faith-based organization.
Family.
Destiny.
Light. Hope.
Charity.
Friendship.
Love. Faith.
This year marks the 70th anniversary of Guiding Light, the longest-running soap opera in history. The show was first created on radio by Erna Phillips, a godmother of the daytime drama.
Erna had started the show to represent the brotherhood of man.
That's Guiding Light's executive producer, Ellen Wheeler.
And to represent what happened as you reach out into the lives of other people and what that makes come back into your own life. And so we wanted to spend our 70th anniversary celebrating that.
And so the soap opera teamed up with a nonprofit group called the Hands-On Network, which has been rebuilding a lot of houses on the Gulf Coast. The gutted remains of Ethel Curry's place was one of three houses Guiding Light adopted in Biloxi.
We'll have four bedrooms here. This area will be the dining room and kitchen. It's going to be open.
Ethel Curry had spent 16 frustrating months trying to find someone to help her rebuild her house. And then, standing in Curry's driveway, was the legendary soap character Reva Shane. You'll recall that Reva is the housekeeper's daughter, married and divorced three times now from Josh Lewis, the billionaire's son. She's the one who drove off a bridge, got amnesia, and then naturally spent 5 years living in an Amish community. Well, anyway, here was Reva Shane in Ethel's driveway wearing a tool belt and a baseball cap.
Just want to get you back in your house.
Yeah. One squeeze on the trigger and that's your now. Okay.
Actor Kim Zimmer, who plays Reva, spent the better part of a week with her colleagues in Biloxi. No makeup or wardrobe, nailing up studs at Ethel Curry's house. They also taped a special installment of the show about the work they did. It was Guiding Light episode 15,108.
Actual walls, we put up doorways, drywall, nails.
At the end of the Biloxi episode, several actors said it was the most moving week of their lives.
Leaving our mark that way, hopefully we can encourage more people to come and volunteer and leave their mark as well.
Now, it would be easy to dismiss Guiding Light's trip to Biloxi as so much marketing smarm. But for Ethel Curry, it means a change in personal fortunes that had grown nearly hopeless. It means a rebuilt house she can move into a few months from now, complete with new furniture.
It is really a gift, a great gift. I've got a lot of smiles, a lot of things to smile for now.
Guiding Light will be back in Biloxi to tape Ethel Curry's triumphant return to her rebuilt house. Meanwhile, there are hundreds of others in Biloxi still struggling to piece their homes back together a year and a half since Katrina hit. From American Radio Works, this is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
And for photos of both this story and our story from Sudan, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, the Pulitzer Prize goes to the Wall Street Journal. The paper actually won two of them, the only publication to do so. The International Reporting Prize lauded the journal's coverage of the rise of capitalism in China. The Public Service Prize went to its reporting of last year's stock options scandal. The manipulation or backdating of executive stock options reached into the far corners of corporate America and prompted the firing of several executives. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 108 points, 0.8%. The Nasdaq picked up 26 points, 1%. The S&P 500 rose 15 points, also 1%. Marketplace producers include Jane Lindholm, Brett Neely, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time, it's always sunny in Berlin.
This shows how much even Germany or even northern parts of Europe, how much solar energy we have and what huge potential. We just have to use it.
I'm Tess Vigeland, and if you'd like to hear our program again, we're podcasting. Head to our website, marketplace.org. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.